Morbidology is a weekly true crime podcast hosted by me, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Unsolved Murders, Cults Uncovered, and Mysteries Uncovered.
911 emergency.
My son shot my husband. I need an ambulance. He's bleeding.
Each week on Morbidology, I uncover a new true crime case using investigative research combined with source audio.
I just snatched it from her. My son had took it and it's like, I just hit her with it.
Morbidology is a victim-focused podcast that mostly covers cases that aren't widely documented in mainstream media. I also like to take an in-depth look at any systemic failures which had a part to play in the crime.
Do you know why you're here?
For a home invasion gone terribly wrong.
Listen to Morbidology across all podcast platforms.
The Oracle Network.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. As always, I'm your host, Paige. Today's episode is about two people with developmental disabilities that met each other and went on a serial killing frenzy. This episode does contain details about the victims and what happened to them. Some are children. This is the story of Deborah Brown, Alton Coleman, and the torture they inflicted to multiple children and adults in many states, leaving the victims' families completely broken. So, if you're ready, buckle up and let's get started. Alton Coleman was born the 6th of November 1955 in Waukegan, Illinois. His mother, who was a sex worker, and his 73-year-old grandmother were the ones who raised him. His mother would often have sex with her clients while her son was in the same room. Alton was developmentally disabled. The kids at his school would harshly make fun of him for that, and the fact that he still peed his pants. They would go around taunting him, calling him pissy. Alton quit school during middle school, and things started to go south from there. Alton began committing crimes, and the local police got to know him very well. He would ruin other people's property and set fires. As each year went by, his crimes got worse and worse. Some sources say that he had the tendency to dress up in women's clothes at the time, and he was struggling with his sexuality. As we will see, he and his soon-to-be partner in crime were a very unorganized, chaotic killing pair. Alton was the one who pretty much told his future partner in crime what to do and selected who they were going to kill. There wasn't a certain victim profile. The murders were solely based on whoever was most convenient at the time. As Alton got older, he desired sex a lot more, which a lot of teenagers and young adults do have a sex drive, and they experiment. But Alton's thoughts and actions were dark. He had a thirst for sex that was unhealthy and could only be quenched by taking advantage of and raping men, women, and children. A friend of Alton's mother stated, quote, "He knew he was different, even as a young child. As he grew up, he was deeply into insidious kinds of sexual gratification," end quote. At only 19 years old, he already was charged for rape, not once or twice, but six times from 1973 to 1983. One of the charges was for the rape of his own 8-year-old niece, his 25-year-old sister's daughter. Alton's sister would later decide to drop the charges on her brother. He may have browbeaten her to drop the charges because he was known to do that to a lot of his victims. Unfortunately, intimidation was something he was very good at. His sister stated in court when she testified weeks later, quote, "It's a misunderstanding. A lot of families go through that. It doesn't make any difference now." End quote. The judge was in total disbelief, saying, quote, "I think the woman, as she stands here today, is terrified of this man." End quote. In the end, the judge had no choice. He had to let Alton go and terminate the charges. Alton even made the jurors believe that the cops had apprehended the wrong person, that it wasn't him, it was someone else. It usually worked like a charm. Two of the cases against him were dismissed. In two other cases, he pleaded guilty to the lesser charges, and he was acquitted two times. According to his friends, Alton also had trust and confidence in the supernatural to assist him in avoiding real justice. He professed that voodoo made him invulnerable to being condemned by the law. He couldn't keep up the act, and his true colors would soon show. Deborah Brown was one of 11 children. She was also intellectually disabled. Deborah suffered trauma to the head as a little girl. People described her as being very dependent on others. In 1983, she and Alton Coleman met. Deborah was engaged at the time, but she left her family behind to move in with him not long after they met. Deborah had never been malicious, violent, or in trouble with the police until she and Alton got together. Alton was supposed to go on trial in Illinois. He was scheduled to be there on charges for raping, and some sources say he even murdered a 14-year-old little girl. Instead, the wanted man and Deborah ran off together and would begin their killing spree. In May of 1984, Alton became friends with a mother of two from Kenosha, Wisconsin. Her name was Juanita Wheat. She had a little girl, only 9 years old, named Vernita, and a 7-year-old little boy named Brandon. Alton told Juanita he was a neighbor of hers named Robert Knight, and even showed her an ID with that name on it. That's how he started to get in good with Juanita. He began to come over to see her and the kids over the next few weeks, having dinner with them and playing with the children. After he befriended the family, he showed up to Juanita's apartment, spent time with her and her children, and met Juanita's cousin, Willie Mae Peebles. On May 29th, 1984, Alton made a surprise visit to Juanita's apartment building, and without being invited inside, he went into the apartment of Juanita's neighbor, Ellen Reeves, whom Juanita was visiting. Juanita introduced Alton to Ellen. With Juanita's permission, Alton took the children to a carnival and had them home by 10:15 that night. He had completely gained her trust by this point. That same night, shortly after he brought the kids home, Juanita said it was fine if her 9-year-old daughter rode with Alton over to his apartment really quick to pick up some of his stereo equipment. He was only using this as an opportunity to kidnap the child and take her back to Waukegan, Illinois. Juanita would not see her daughter alive again. When Alton had not brought her daughter home by 10:45 that night, Juanita and Ellen started to look for her. Approximately 1 hour later, Juanita called the police. The two women identified Alton's picture, who they thought was Robert Knight this whole time, at the police station and in court later. Vernita's body was found in an abandoned building, in the bathroom, on the 19th of June, 1984, terribly decomposed. The cause of her death was from being strangled with a ligature. Her chest, neck, and hands were bound with cable wire. This deserted building that Vernita was in was only 4 blocks away from Alton's grandmother's apartment. There were fingerprints at the scene, and later, those would come in handy. On the 31st of May, only a day or two after the murder of Vernita, Alton became chummy with Robert Carpenter, who lived in Waukegan as well. Robert let him stay the night with him, and the next day, Alton asked to borrow his car to make a quick run to the store. Robert said sure, but Alton never came back. On the 1st of June, Deborah was actually taken in for questioning about Alton's sudden disappearance. So the pair laid low for a few weeks after that. Deborah and Alton went to Gary, Indiana later in June. They came across 2 very young girls, Annie, who was 9, and Tamika Turks, who was 7. They had just been to a hot dog stand and a candy store, walking back to Tamika's home. Alton and Deborah went up to the little girls and asked them if they wanted new clothes. Of course, 2 little girls being asked if they wanted new clothes, they were all for it. Alton told them to go with Deborah and that he'd catch up later. Tamika did tell Annie, as they were walking, that she didn't think they should be with these people. They continued to take a walk with Deborah, who lured them into a wooded area close by. They walked for about 40 minutes. Alton showed up and told the girls that he was going to play a game. Deborah and Alton took off Tamika's shirt, and then they ripped up her shirt and used the pieces to tie the girls up and gag them. Deborah was agitated that Tamika was crying and terrified, so she put her hand over the little girl's nose and mouth, taking her to the ground, while Alton took his foot and started to stomp her in the face, chest, and stomach. But that wasn't enough. They took her away from Annie, where she couldn't see her friend, in a pile of weeds, and Alton raped Tamika orally, saying that if she didn't do what he said, that he would kill Annie. After he did this to Tamika, they went over to Annie. It was her turn to be horribly tortured. Alton raped 9-year-old Annie, and then there was a loud moaning sound coming from Tamika. Realizing Tamika was not dead yet, they choked Annie with a belt until she fainted. They went to Tamika and strangled her to death. Luckily, Annie survived the savage attack. Even though Annie survived, her grandmother could not take what had happened to her little granddaughter. It was too much for her to handle, and she completed suicide. Tamika was found on June 19th. Her body was partially decayed, and the cause of her death was strangulation with a ligature. Annie still undergoes serious headaches, and she has moments where she just starts screaming. Her mother, Mary, said, quote, "She will get to screaming and crying like someone is hitting her on the back of the head," end quote. Annie's medical bills for her injuries were $15,000. Some of it was covered by insurance, but a bulk of it wasn't, which would be financially difficult for most families. Laverne, Tamika's mother, decided to move to Minneapolis and decided to reside there because the memories of Tamika and Gary, Indiana were too excruciating to bear. Now let's take a breather, take a short commercial break, and let me tell you about today's sponsor. I must admit, it's hard for me to find jewelry that I'm in love with, but when Ana Luisa reached out to sponsor the show, I looked at their website and instantly fell in love. These pieces go with everything I own, which is impossible for me personally to ever find. I'm mostly a t-shirt and leggings kind of girl, unless I just have to go somewhere and dress up. These pieces work if you're all dolled up or completely dressed down. One pair of earrings I picked out are called Celeste, which are tiny, huggy hoops with a star on one side and a half moon on the other, adorned with tiny sparkling gems that are the cutest touch. Another pair is called Farina. They're chic and dreamy little half moons with clear and pastel gems and linear drops. The necklace I picked is called Nina. It's a vintage, skinny, silver rope necklace with a beautiful, almost see-through, super light, sky blue topaz gem. The quality of these pieces stunned me in the best way. They are sustainable, lovely, and like I said, they're super versatile. They really do have jewelry for everyone, and you can find timeless pieces for someone that you love as well at AnnaLuisa.com. AnnaLuisa.com. Their jewelry will not break the bank like most places, and that to me is super important. Check out AnnaLuisa.com and use the code TRUECRIME for a discount. That's AnnaLuisa.com, and True Crime is the discount code. Oh, by the way, I went back and bought the Sia Link earring. You can buy just one for one ear if you want to, but I was like, no, I want two for both ears. I have my ears pierced twice, so this one was yelling my name. It's a small safety pin that goes in your earlobe, and for your second piercing right above that is a little silver gem, and they're connected by a delicate, pretty chain. It's a little edgy, but still screams contemporary and adorable. AnnaLuisa.com, AnnaLuisa.com, discount code TRUECRIME. The same day that the police found Tamika's body was the same day Alton and 25-year-old Donna Williams of Gary, Indiana were hanging out, and he, of course, had the motive of becoming her so-called friend for terrible reasons. He wound up abducting Donna in her own car. She was reported missing. Donna's body was discovered in Detroit, Michigan on the 11th of July, decomposed badly. She was about a half a mile away from her car. Her cause of death was also ligature strangulation. Also, where her car was found was 4 blocks away from Alton's grandmother's residence. People that lived in the area said the car had been parked there since June 19th, the same day Tamika's body was found. Robert and Zanata, Donna's parents, said punishment was not what was on their minds the most. Zanata told the Detroit Free Press 3 years after her daughter was found, quote, "I will always wonder what exactly happened," end quote. 2 days after Donna had been reported missing, probably around the 21st of June, a lady in Detroit had been taken hostage. She was forced to drive a man and woman to Toledo. However, taking the two by surprise, this woman took a chance to get out of there by hitting another vehicle and took off running afterwards. Later, she identified Deborah and Alton as her kidnappers. On the 28th of June, Deborah and Alton were in Dearborn Heights, Michigan, and went into Mr. and Mrs. Palmer Jones's house. Alton slapped handcuffs on the man and started to beat him mercilessly. Mrs. Jones was also attacked severely. Before they left the couple's home, Alton grabbed the phone and tore it from the wall. They stole all the money they could find, and they stole the married couple's car. Alton and Deborah were now in Toledo, Ohio in July of 1984. Virginia Temple, unfortunately, met Alton, who did his routine of befriending his victims. She had a few children, and her oldest was a 9-year-old little girl named Rochelle. All of a sudden, relatives of Virginia stopped hearing from her, and they could not get in touch with her as much as they tried. They were worried about her and the kids. Some of her relatives decided to go to their house, and as soon as they went in, the children were all by themselves and were visibly scared to death. In a crawl space, the family members saw the bodies of Virginia and her daughter Rochelle. There was a bracelet missing from the house, but this will come up very soon. Virginia and Rochelle had been choked to death. The very same day that Alton and Deborah killed Virginia and Rochelle, they went into another house. This was the home of Frank and Dorothy Duvendack, who lived in Toledo as well. Alton cut the cords of different appliances and phones and tied the couple up as they ransacked the home. The pair searched until they found money and jewelry. After they were finished looting the couple's home, they also stole their car. Still the same day, Alton and Deborah went to Dayton, Ohio, and showed up at the Gage residence. The husband was a reverend. They spent the night with the married couple and even went with them to church on July the 9th. The following day, Mr. and Mrs. Gay took Alton and Deborah to downtown Cincinnati, where they wanted to be dropped off. On the 11th of July, 15-year-old Tony Story was reported missing in Cincinnati, Ohio, when she never came home from school. Yvette Lewis, Tony's classmate, testified that she saw Tony walking with Alton and Deborah at 6 in the evening on July 11, 1984. Tony's body was not found until the 21st of July in a vacant building, and she had been strangled to death. A bracelet was underneath her body, which was the one missing from the home of the Temples. Deborah's fingerprint was found on Tony's Michael Jackson button, which was 10 feet away from her body. A shoe print matching Alton's was also near Tony's body. On the 12th of July, 1984, the FBI were on to Alton Coleman, and now he was the 388th person to be on their 10 most wanted list. Alton and Deborah took a bicycle ride to Norwood, Ohio on July 13th around 9:30 in the morning. They were in the house of another couple, Harry and Marlene Walters, at 10:30 that morning. They explained to the Walters that they were fascinated by the travel trailer that they were selling and that they were interested in buying it. They were welcomed into their home, and once Alton and Deborah were inside, all hell broke loose. Alton grabbed a candlestick and beat Marlene around 25 times. As if that wasn't enough, a pair of vice grips were used to completely maim her face and scalp. By the time they fled the scene in the couple's Plymouth vehicle, Harry was beaten to unconsciousness, eventually going to the hospital to find out he suffered brain damage, and his poor wife Marlene succumbed to her injuries. Her death was caused by hits so hard to the head that it caused skull fractures and brain injuries. Alton's fingerprints were found both inside and outside of the house. Harry Walters was in a coma until September of that year. Alton and Deborah were vicious, ruthless, and started to get messy, which would eventually catch up to them. When the two left in the Walters' car, they'd stolen money, jewelry, and shoes. They left behind their bikes and even left some of their own clothes and shoes at the scene. Only 2 days later, the Red Plymouth Reliant was found deserted in Kentucky. Deborah and Alton abducted a college professor, Olene Carmichael Jr., in Williamsburg, Kentucky, then drove away with Olene in the trunk of his own vehicle back to Dayton, Ohio. From the 15th to the 17th, Olene was locked away in the trunk before the deserted car was finally found and he was saved by law enforcement. Unfortunately, Millard and Catherine Gay would be visited again by the pair. However, this time, Alton Coleman was being searched for nationwide, and the Gays knew this. When the Reverend opened his door, he and his wife were packing heat, and understandably so. Millard said to Alton, quote, "Why you want to do us like that? Like this?" And Alton said, quote, "I'm not going to kill you, but we generally kill them where we go." The only damage done was Alton and Deborah taking Millard and Catherine's car and speeding away. On their way back to where they lived in Evanston, Illinois, they murdered a 77-year-old man named Eugene Scott and took off in his car. Eugene was found in a ditch near Indianapolis, Indiana, on July 19th. Alton, not knowing that he was on the FBI's most wanted list, he and Deborah were back in their hometown, crossing the street, while someone was sitting at a red light who recognized him on July 20th. I don't know if he forgot he was wanted for his prior rape and murder charge before he fled, or if he just didn't care. Nevertheless, he and Deborah were back in their hometown. As the couple walked off into the distance, the person who saw them turned into the next gas station and called police. Alton and Deborah were enjoying their day, thinking they had gotten away with all the horrible things they had done, maybe even plotting where they would go next, when undercover police were searching the area and saw the two sitting at Mason Park. The police took note that the two were wearing different t-shirts than what the person who called in said they were wearing. The policemen slowly got out of their cars because they knew how violent and desperate these two were and strolled up to the pair. Alton was trying to sneakily walk away from the park, but two officers stopped him in his tracks. The detective and two sergeants went up to Alton and began asking him a lot of questions. When the cops were searching Deborah, in her purse they found a gun. She said her name was Denise Johnson. Alton had no ID and even said he had no idea who Alton was. Both were arrested on the spot and hauled off to the Evanston Police Department, where the police took their fingerprints and identified them immediately. The two could no longer deny who they really were. Alton was stripped down and searched thoroughly. He had on two pairs of sweat socks and had a steak knife tucked between them. When they were arrested, they had shopping bags full of clothes and hats. Every 3 or 4 blocks, they would change their clothes and put on different hats, thinking that would help them not be recognized. Now, the fact of the matter is, most of their victims were black. It is speculated that they knew if they targeted black people, someone in the neighborhood that they were in at the time might give them a place to hide. Unlike if he and Deborah were to have attempted this spree in white neighborhoods, they probably would have been caught much sooner, for multiple reasons. Everyone that lived in the area was so glad Deborah and Alton had now been caught. It was a huge relief because everyone had a feeling they would be back. A lot of people said Alton looked worn out and it seemed like he had lost a lot of weight. People in the area said that by then, both of them had, quote, probably just run out of steam. One neighbor said, quote, there was a community awareness about him. He wasn't going to be able to come in here and snatch anybody. We were waiting for him, end quote. While Deborah was at the Evanston police station, there was an FBI agent who told Deborah her rights, and according to court documents, he went on to ask her questions like her name, age, date of birth, and address. He went on to ask her different things to get her to give him clues to an attack in his jurisdiction that they were suspected of. While Deborah was being taken to federal lockup, she decided to openly talk to FBI agents on the way to Chicago. They explained her rights to her again when they got to the federal building, and she didn't want to sign the waiver agreement for that. Deborah said she would talk to police, but if she wanted to stop talking, she wanted to be able to do that. Hours later, she had divulged a lot of details, confessing about their crimes and murders. After she spent hours talking, then she asked for a lawyer. They didn't ask her any questions after that until she spoke to an attorney. During trial, Deborah's attorney said her Fifth Amendment right, the right against self-incrimination, was disregarded because authorities kept on interrogating her after she had first asked for an attorney in the beginning, but she didn't ask for one the second time. So they did ignore her request for an attorney when they first brought her in for questioning. Since the detective in Evanston did infringe upon her rights, the evidence from his questioning at that time was excluded. However, the confession she gave to the agents was used in the trial, and because of that, she was quickly convicted. Deborah was served a death sentence for the murder of Tamika Turks. Later, she was given another death sentence for the murders committed in Cincinnati, but she continued to be held on Indiana's death row. It had only been maybe a week after they had been taken into custody when more than 50 law enforcement officials from Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Kentucky, and Ohio got together to figure out a plan to prosecute Alton and Deborah. Since Michigan does not have the death penalty, they decided not to go with Michigan as a starting point for a trial. Ohio was the agreed-upon state to have the first trial for this murderous pair. They had committed 8 murders, 7 rapes, 3 abductions, and 14 robberies in which they were armed. U.S. Attorney Dan K. Webb stated, quote, "We are convinced that the prosecution in Ohio can most quickly and most likely result in the swiftest imposition of the death penalty against Alton Coleman and Deborah Brown," end quote. The attorney was absolutely right. At the Ohio trial, May of 1985, the two were found guilty and convicted for aggravated murder charges for the murder of Tony Story. The next month, they were convicted for killing Marlene Walters, along with so many other violent and vicious criminal conduct. Since they were both sentenced to be executed, they started to appeal, which was such a long, drawn-out process. Also, I wanted to mention that at his trial, Alton argued on his own behalf, like Ted Bundy did, and that did not go well, obviously. It's total narcissism because Alton was always used to talking a jury in the past into believing him, and they would let him walk. but in this case, it didn't work for him. A part of his closing argument was, quote, "I am very shocked that I have to be accidentally brought before the court, representing myself for the reason because I want to be heard. Yes, I don't want to hide behind no lawyer. Alton Coleman want to be heard and don't care if no one like it. I want to be heard, period. Don't want to hide behind no lawyer. I don't want to stick behind a lawyer who speak for me. Alton Coleman gonna speak for himself, and he is gonna speak for himself because I have something to say. And if it's like me or you don't, it doesn't have the bearings on what you have to do." End quote. So you can kind of see why this didn't work out so well for him. After the court sentenced him to death, Alton asked that the counsel be reappointed for his post-trial hearing. The circuit court reappointed the public defender, Pantsios. As Pantsios was familiar with the proceedings, she represented Alton. Soon thereafter, Alton expressed his dissatisfaction with Pantsios. In response, the circuit court made the following finding. The court said, quote, "You have attempted to manipulate the proceedings." Alton said, quote, "You can call it what you want, Your Honor." The court said, quote, "And I am. And you tried to frustrate this proceeding by raising specious objections, withdrawing them, asking for Mrs. Pantsios to be appointed, and then saying you don't want her." End quote. The record supports the circuit court's finding that the defendant did use his right to counsel and his right to waive counsel in a manner that was designed to frustrate and manipulate the proceedings. From 1985 to 2002, Alton's case was taken repeatedly to the Supreme Court. However, all of his arguments, which were tons, about his sentence being unlawful were never approved and immediately shut down. In April of 2002, Alton's attempts at prolonging his execution had come to an end. There was one final try on April 25th, 2002, when Alton's attorneys claimed to the Ohio Supreme Court that it wasn't fair to let so many loved ones of the murder victims and people who had survived their attacks to watch him be executed because it was, quote, turning it into a spectator sport. So many people came to watch Alton die that prison officials had to fix up a closed circuit viewing outside. Alton's last meal was a humongous one. Filet mignon, well done, with a lot of onions, fried chicken breasts, salad with French dressing, and a sweet potato pie with whipped cream on top, French fries, collard greens, onion rings, cornbread, broccoli with melted cheese to dip it in, and biscuits with gravy. That is a lot of food. And he also had a cherry Coke to drink. As he started to say, "The Lord is my shepherd," on April 26, 2002, he was given a lethal injection in Lucasville, Ohio, in their state prison death chamber. There was no remorse at all from Alton before he died. As for Deborah, there were some issues that came up in her trial. The trial court considered a potential mitigating factor of whether Deborah was under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance at the time of the murders. The court found that although there was some evidence that she was acting under, quote, mental or emotional disturbance when the crimes herein were committed, Deborah did not qualify as being under a mental or emotional disturbance of such an extreme nature as to excuse her conduct in the commission of these offenses. Another consideration was whether Deborah acted under the significant domination of another person. The judge noted that Deborah was, quote, a young woman with borderline intellectual functioning with a dependent personality disorder. He also noted the relationship between Deborah's dependent personality and Alton's dominant manipulative personality. The court decided, however, that Deborah was not so greatly dominated that, quote, she could not make a rational choice as to her own participation in repeated violent and criminal acts accompanied by repeated efforts to deceive intended victims and others to evade prosecution, end quote. In the end, Deborah also received a death sentence. Ohio Governor Richard F. Celeste later altered it. Because of this, Deborah, 39 at the time, was kept locked up in Ohio, costing taxpayers $200,000. In 2002, she was awaiting her death sentence, which was to be in Indiana because of what the governor decided in Ohio. A spokeswoman for the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction stated, quote, "We can't just send her over there. A request has to be made by Indiana authorities." Governor Celeste was against the death penalty, which is why he decided on January 10, 1991, that Deborah should spend life in prison instead. A few days after making that decision, he left office. In Celeste's own words, he said that he, quote, spared Deborah's life because she was the R word, which I won't say, and she had a childlike emotional development along with a, quote, master-slave relationship with Alton Coleman, end quote. 7-year-old Tamika Turks was murdered in Gary, Indiana, so Deborah's death sentence awaited her there whenever the authorities would call for her. Of course, she has appealed it in the U.S. District Court in Columbus, Ohio. The officials in Indiana were prosecuting her case, and Deborah's lawyers were out-of-state public defenders that were appointed by the court. The governor of Indiana and other officials said right after Governor of Ohio Celeste's resentencing that they were going to file a request right away to transfer Deborah to Indiana. Well, that would never happen. A part of that could have been all of the criticism over how costly it was to bring both Alton, at the time, and Deborah to Indiana for a trial in 1986, because that was right after Ohio had found them guilty of murder and sentenced them. A spokeswoman for the Indiana Department of Correction, Pam Pattison, said, quote, "Ohio has a lawful right to hold Deborah as well as Indiana. There has been discussion about bringing her back to Indiana. Ohio kept her," end quote. However, Pam never gave a reason why Indiana has not requested to transfer Deborah over there. In 2002, Deborah was in the Ohio Reformatory for Women in Marysville. If they were to extradite Deborah over to the Indiana Women's Prison in Indianapolis, it would cost the taxpayers over $19,000 a year. When Alton was alive, he and Deborah were no longer in a relationship, and they never tried to communicate with each other, according to one of Alton's attorneys. Deborah's mother hates that her daughter got entangled with Alton, because in the beginning, like I said, she had never been violent, malicious, or had problems with police at all until she met him. Alton's family says they are victims of him too. Not victims of Alton himself, but more so victims of the system that they wholeheartedly believe planned to kill an innocent man. Talk about denial. As of 2019, Deborah was no longer on death row facing execution, but she will be serving life in prison. And that concludes today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay safe and take care.